in the Fireside Building this morning. We have Karen Ward. Her session number is 98-1, titled Getting Ready for Worship in the 21st Century. Let's listen in.
Towards the next century. And I've been one of your representatives from the ELCA on that worldwide worship and culture study team. We had a North American contingent to that, which is basically three people, two from the United States, myself and Dr. Mark Bangert from Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, and a pastor from the Lutheran Church in Canada. And we represented the North American contingent to this study team. And we've been working for the past 6 years on issues surrounding worship and culture. As we all know, the 21st century is practically upon us now. And everyone in the church is looking at the new millennium and what it will mean in terms of whatever topic area you can think of related to the church. And worship is one of those areas. What does the 21st century mean in terms of our worship, particularly in our own context of North America? And the study team looked at these issues, and we came up with about four different kind of overall general trends or categories that we thought it was important for our study team to deal with in terms of worship in the 21st century. What could this mean for us? And those four areas that we thought might impact worship in relationship to the 21st century in North America are these four things. I mean, there are others, but these are kind of overarching umbrella categories. The first one is racial diversity. Second one is cultural diversity. The third one is the information age and all that means. And the fourth one is the post-Christian century. I'm just going to spend a little bit of time talking about these four overarching categories. And they are quite large. And underneath each one of them, there's a whole series of issues. The first one, racial diversity. All of the demographers that we've talked to have, you probably heard this on the news many times, about the demographic shifts that are happening in North America and that will continue to happen well into the next century. Demographic experts tell us that by the year 2020, 50% of the population of North America will be non-European in origin, 50%. And you can already see that happening in certain parts of North America, particularly, for example, California is fast approaching that reality already today. And what will that mean for the society? That's a big question. We're not going to deal with that here. But what is it going to mean for the church and the church's worship? Next category, cultural diversity. And it's related to the racial issue, but it's broader than that. In terms of immigration patterns coming to North America, there's new groups that are landing on the shores. We're all familiar with the early patterns of immigration that brought a lot of our Lutheran ancestors, quote unquote, here, the great migrations from Europe. But now the patterns seem to be shifting in terms of where people, where the boats are coming from when they're landing. We're getting more and more boats from Africa, more and more boats from Asia. It's very interesting to see this Asian phenomenon happening in the western part of the United States and Canada. I was recently in Vancouver, British Columbia, and I got to the airport and I looked around and I felt like I was in Hong Kong. And basically I was, Hong Kong West. There's a tremendous amount of Asian immigration to Cascadia, all the region of the Northwest, whether it's in Seattle or Portland or Vancouver, and that's a very strong pattern there. We're getting more Arab people coming to this country. The diversity is just increasing. And with that comes cultural pluralism and multiculturalism. And that affects the society, we all know, and it will affect the churches, and it's starting to affect the churches. The third mega category is the advent of the information age. And it's hard to say, you know, what all this means, but basically we're becoming a cyber society in many ways. People are being plugged in their lives, computers, and all that computers bring us, the good and the bad, are affecting the world and the church. I think the ELCA has this program now where we're trying to wire, quote unquote, the entire church. We've got the synods hooked up already. Every ELCA synod is on this web network of the ELCA, and now the next step would be every congregation. And that's going to take quite a long time to do, because over 50% of our congregations don't have computers. It's a stereotype that they all do, and about 60% of them don't have web capacity. They have computers. Some of them use them just for making bulletins. The next step would be getting the email and the World Wide Web and all that hookup. But the goal is, you know, eventually that most of our congregations will be electronicized or computerized in the next century. And that has massive implications as well for worship. And we all know, you know, what some congregations are doing in terms of self-publishing service folders that are coming off computers in their full form. And a lot of our bigger churches are already pioneering that kind of, I call it do-it-yourself worship, which is underneath that trend. And then the fact that this coming century is often described by many scholars as post-Christian, which doesn't mean that there's not Christians. I mean, there's plenty of Christians around. But the fact is that society at large can no longer be looked to support, uphold, and transfer the meaning and the culture and the traditions of Christianity to the society. In former times, especially coming out of the European context, Christians were used to having the culture be a partner in the transmission of the faith. People could get catechism in schools. There were prayers in school. The society supported Christian holidays. We still have remnants of that in our culture with Christmas breaks and holidays, which is, of course, comes from holy days. It originated there. And you can see all the cultural shifting that's going on with whether or not schools are going to allow religious breaks, and if so, what are they? Christmas was assumed, now it's not being assumed in many places. And well, we give Hanukkah breaks and, you know, Ramadan breaks and everything. It's just a different reality of a pluralistic religious environment. So we can't look to the culture to Christianize people for us. It's something the church has to go back to its own way of making believers without the culture's assistance. And that's a new reality for the church. It's kind of the situation that the early church faced when it was a pre-Christian context. So all of these things have our coming realities that are partially here and will continue to come to us as we enter the 21st century. That's a lot of diversity. The church has always been diverse in many ways. When Lutheran ancestors came over on the boats from Europe, they were bringing diversity to this country as well. And we're all familiar with that kind of diversity. And I can describe this diversity in kind of three different categories of what the church has been dealing with. The first one would be the category of identity. The second one of unity. And then the third one I'm going to call unity and diversity, of the waves of how the church has been dealing with diversity over time. The first wave was the identity wave, as I call it, when all the boats came over from the various European shores, the Danes and the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Germans. And if you recall, all the different Lutheran churches that were set up to represent all those ethnicities, and they were separate churches. There was a Danish church and a Norwegian church and various German churches and so on. Basically because those churches wanted to preserve their identities from Europe. And so they set up their denominations to do that. The German Lutherans came, and they set up German Lutheran churches with German services, German schools, to teach the people, to maintain their religious and cultural heritage. And all the different ethnic groups did that. And for the past 100 years or so, Lutherans have been working to get beyond that first identity project into the next one, which was the Unity Project, to bring all these disparate European Lutheran groups under one umbrella. And we're still in the remnants of that project, quote unquote, with all these different mergers of Lutherans. And you know these mergers in this alphabet soup better than I do, probably, with the merging the Norwegians, and then the Norwegians and the Germans, and then the Swedes, and the various attempts to have Lutheran unity that's based on a North American Lutheran identity that was not based in the language traditions of the former churches. Basically trying to worship in English together, abandoning the German service, the Swedish language, trying to come together in English. And the ELCA is one of the products of the last phase of this Unity Project. If we look at that in terms of worship, we can see what Henry Muhlenberg, his dream, is also kind of a liturgical version of this Unity Project. Muhlenberg, one of the fathers of the Lutheran Church in America, had this grand vision of trying to unite and worship all of these different Lutheran ethnic groups. He had a vision of one Lutheran church in North America and one Lutheran service book. That was Muhlenberg's dream, to work toward what we call, eventually ended up calling, the common service, which would unite the different Lutherans in terms of worship in English with one book. And basically, Muhlenberg's dream came true, pretty much. We got the common service book, and then after that, we got the Lutheran Book of Worship, which more than any other book did the job of Muhlenberg to try to bring most of the Lutherans in this continent together in terms of a single book. And if you say the Missouri Synod is a part of that, which they were, then the Muhlenberg dream did actually come to pass to a certain extent, that most of North American Lutherans had something to do with the Lutheran Book of Worship. But what now? We've got new books coming, different kinds of people. What happens now to Muhlenberg's dream? You get a lot of phone calls at the churchwide office about worship in my department. And one of my favorite calls came from a pastor in Pennsylvania last year. And he called up and he said, I'd like to speak with somebody in worship. And I said, well, I'm somebody in worship. He goes, well, you people really are clever. And I said, well, what do you mean by that, Pastor? He says, well, you're just really chipping away, aren't you? Chipping away at our unity. I can hear the marble hitting the floor. That's what he said. And what that pastor meant was that he perceived what was going on in the church now in terms of the new diversity that's springing up in worship as a threat to the unity project of the church. Muhlenberg, he said, would probably have a fit. What is going on? What happened to one church, one book? Where did this blue book come from? He said, and who authorized it? What are you trying to do? Divide the church, quote unquote. The pastor was on to something there. I don't want to look at it in terms of dividing the church, but he was still operating in the unity phase, where many quarters of the church are looking towards the next phase, which is the Unity and Diversity Project, which we're just embarking on now in the last 10 years or so. And that's the project that at least the worship staffs in both the churchwide and the Augsburg are working under that rubric. So when we come up with the unity folk, we get black. There's still some people in the identity phase. But this is a new phase, and we're all going to have to get used to these changes. And they're not all bad, but they can be frightening going into the new century. And people are saying, well, what is unifying us as Lutherans? We've got all these books floating around. We've got some congregations are still using the red book. We've got many of the congregations that have the green book. And now almost half of our congregations have the blue, the little blue book. And there's a new book that was just published, the Red Book, which is the new Spanish worship book. And we're going to have the Burgundy book, coming out next April, which is our new African American worship book. And we have, I don't know what color it will be, but next April, the contemporary song book of the ELCA will come out. So, how many books is that? What does that mean for our unity? Does that mean we're going our separate ways? Or is there something else coming? I think the project has changed now. Muhlenberg, if he were alive today, would want to say to him that there's a different project underway. But we do need to maintain his concern for unity in the church. But what unifies us? If it's not one book, and really it's already beyond being one book. And I didn't even mention congregations that are doing self-publishing, congregations that use resources from other churches. If you have the hymnal supplement 1991 in your pews, that other Burgundy book, that's from the Catholic Church's publishing house, and that's very, very popular in Lutheran congregations. So there already are many books, not necessarily replacing the Green Book, but supplementing it. So what do we base our unity on? Well, some of us have been trying to look at this issue, and we've come up with a proposal for the church, for unity, that's not necessarily based on one book, one church, but the new proposal, which is a theory, which we don't know how it's going to be accepted or not accepted in the church, is one church, one pattern for worship. And with one voice, we try to lift out for the first time the pattern in our worship, which we see as something that can unite the church on the one hand, but allow for a lot of flexibility and diversity on the other hand. I don't know, many of your congregations probably have With One Voice in the pew. In the front of With One Voice, there's some teaching material on the nature of worship and the underlying pattern we're seeking to go back to. Turn to page 6 and
look on
the
board
so we can
get a copy.
Page what? Page 6.
Thank you.
So we got page 6. On page 6, at the bottom of the page, is a 4-paragraph description of Christian worship, which is the earliest description that the church has about what Christian worship originally was like. And this description gives to us a basic pattern for worship that's behind all the different books, and even the books of different denominations. And we're trying to open up the pattern, which frees the details to be filled in by congregations in their diversity. Would somebody like to volunteer to read this out loud? The Justin quote there.
Where it says on Sunday?
On Sunday, yeah.
Okay. On Sunday all are gathered together in unity. Records of the apostle or the writings of the prophets are read for as long as time will allow. The presider exhorts and invites us into the pattern of those good things. Then we all stand and offer prayer. When we have concluded the prayer, bread is set out together with wine. The presider then offers prayer and thanksgiving, and the people sing out their assent, saying the Amen. There is a distribution of the things over which thanks has been set, and each person participates, and these things are sent to those who are not present. Those who are prosperous give what they wish according to each own's choice. And the collection is deposited with the presider, who aids orphans and widows, those in want because of disease, those in prison, and foreigners who are staying here. We hold this meeting together on Sunday, since it is the first day on which God, having transformed darkness and matter, created the world. On the same day, Jesus Christ, our Savior, rose from the dead. On Sunday, he appeared to the apostles and disciples and taught them these things which we present to you.
Now, this comes from the year 150 AD, which is about maybe 30 or so years after the writing of the Gospel of John. It's the earliest description of Christian worship that we have intact. And Justin was writing this to the emperor of Rome, because the emperor wanted to know what these Christians were up to, because this is the time when the persecutions were about to begin, and the church was considered a mysterious group, and the government considered the church to be suspect, and wanted to know what these Christians were doing when they gathered together. So Justin wrote this apology to the emperor to try to explain to somebody outside the church what the church did in these quote-unquote secret meetings every week when they gathered together. So he wasn't writing this, you know, he was writing it to explain the basics of what Christians were about. And if you notice this pattern, it should look very familiar. Gathering together, the records of the apostles and the writings of the prophets, which we would know as the scriptures, for as long as time allows, I don't know about that part now. Presider exhorting us into the pattern, we would call that preaching. Prayers, we all know what those are. Bread and wine, prayer of thanksgiving, the distribution. And what's very striking about this early account is that we recognize this familiar pattern of gathering the word, the meal, and the sending, as we describe it, the four-part structure with one voice. But on top of this pattern, there is an ethical component that's very, very strong in the early church. And I think that's something we need to look at again, that the context of caring for the poor, doing justice, taking communion out to those who are sick and homebound, caring for those in prison and foreigners, that's a very strong ethical overlay to the pattern. But basically, the pattern has been preserved. It's in the LBW, although it's not as easy to lift it out. It's in With One Voice. It's in the Book of Common Prayer. It's in the Roman Catholic Mass. It's in the Presbyterian Service Book. It's common across many, many churches. And it can be freely adapted. And that's what we want to concentrate on for the rest of our short time, as adapting that pattern to fit local context. I like to call it do-it-yourself liturgy, in a way. Not that we can create liturgy ex nihilo. I've done this exercise with youth a lot at a youth gathering workshops on worship, where youth will say, well, our worship is boring at our church. I wish we could just get rid of it and just make our own worship. So I say, sure, let's do that. So they always have an exercise on liturgy building with young people. And I let them go off in groups by themselves and devise their own liturgy and come back, and we share it amongst the groups, what they've come up with. And we write everything on the board. And by the time we get done writing, what we have is Justin. It might be a reversal in order, or the confession may come at the beginning or the middle, but basically the components are there. Singing, praying, sermon, word, communion, sending. Those things have been around for 2,000 years, and no one seems to come up with a better pattern. They may, like I say, rearrange the parts a little bit, or you add different styles or whatever to it, but the pattern remains the same. And that's what can unify us in our diversity, is the pattern. But filling in the pattern, that's the job of local congregations, to make the pattern fit the context. And that's hard work, and that's the work that all of us have to be engaged in, especially when we have so many resources now. We can have all the books we want. We've got 5 or 6 of our own, plus all the books from the other churches, electronic resources, CD-ROMs. But still, once you have all these resources, you have to put them together. You have to put flesh on the skeleton of the pattern. And right now, we're going to look at a videotape. It's from the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has been working on worship and culture issues for a very long time, because they're such a very diverse community. And their pattern of worship is basically the same as ours, same as the Methodists or Presbyterians, in its skeletal form. I mean, there are peculiarities to each tradition. But this shows how some African-American people in the Catholic Church are trying to take this pattern of Justin and make it their own to fit African-American Christians within the context of the Catholic Church. So when you look at this, think about your congregation or the different ethnic groups within our church. Think about the pattern. And think about how they are taking this pattern in the worship and making it speak to the culture that they're trying to speak to. And we're going to have a little bit of discussion afterwards. Let's see if I can work this contraption.
Of the warmth than it was a generator of.
Okay, we're going to stop the tape now. It goes on, a lot of the time we had, you start talking a little bit. Let's have some discussion about worship and culture, and don't let it be limited to African Americans. I mean, this is a tape about African Americans putting their culture into the common pattern. But all across the ELCA, this is starting to happen in all kinds of cultures, whether it's African American or Latino. There's a lot going on with the suburban, quote unquote, culture or what as well. You know, we have a lot of these bigger churches that have contemporary music in their worship services, and that's a cultural adaptation as well. It's adapting to, I don't know which culture you want to ascribe that to, suburban or whatever, but the pop-driven liturgies, that's a part of it too. That's culture in a way. It's not ethnic culture, but it's a different kind of culture. Asians, Native Americans, we're all trying to approach this pattern, bringing it, as the woman said in the video, bringing yourself to church. It seems like a simple concept, but it's a lot more complex to really take into account what it means when people bring themselves to church.
But when you said that California was about to become a majority of non-whites, and I am a demographer, so
yeah.
And I believe it has already
is
happened.
Is it really?
In California.
Okay, I didn't want to overspeak.
But also, and the video is a wonderful example. But I ran across some information recently that within a generation that I should live to see it, African Americans will no longer be the largest minority group.
Right.
Hispanics
yes.
will.
Yeah.
And within two or three generations, they will fragment inevitably into other self-defined groups. And even in this state, the largest minority group is Asian.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 89% of the population.
Right. I mean,
it's more complicated
mm-hmm.
than even that.
Oh yeah, a lot of parishes are dealing with multicultural realities. I had a church in Philadelphia that I was a part of, an African American church, and then some Latino people began to come into the neighborhood, and a few of those people somehow, I mean, we didn't have any intentional outreach at all to the Latinos coming into the neighborhood, but some of them came to our church, and the African American people did not know what to do. Just like a white congregation when somebody else comes. We had the same issues. Like, well, we don't know any Spanish. Should we learn some? Should we put something in Spanish in the service? I mean, but this is our church, isn't it? Or whose church is it? God's church? Our church? The neighborhood's church? So the issues are going to be confounding all of us, whether it's, you know, a monocultural situation, so-called monocultural, which I don't know if that really exists, but
even got to have
where one group predominates.
Role reversal.
Yeah.
For a while, for several years, I lived in Hawaii, and one year my church sent me to the local synod convention, and Hawaii is tacked on to Orange County because Orange County is rich enough to fly us all over there.
Right.
So It's. I mean, you're a minority when you're a Lutheran in Hawaii to begin with, and then when you're a Hawaiian Lutheran in Orange County, this is a whole other experience. So trying to explain what is basically a predominantly Asian Lutheran community, of which you are a minority member of that, to Orange County is a large convention there is you suddenly know what it's like to be the only one you look like standing on a subway station.
Like I said, this cultural and multicultural reality, and you could even put all kinds of other things into the cultural definition, but I don't want to get into all these issues about gay and lesbian cultures, I mean non-ethnic based cultures, the youth and where culture, almost every group can say the women's movement, how that's affected worship, it already has to do with language issues. So there's all kinds of cultures depending upon all of the worship in all of our churches. And it's just, how do we deal with it? And the LWF study tries to give us tools as we localize our liturgy, because really the solutions have to be local, because each situation and each congregation is different. So we cannot have any kind of packaged liturgy that we send out from Higgins Road that's gonna fit your community. We can give you tools and a toolbox, which is a common toolbox. But from there, you gotta build it yourself. Do it yourself with a common base and a common structure. And trying to help people do that is what we're trying to do now. In terms of culture, the LWF study came out with four categories that they hope are helpful as congregations face crafting their own liturgy in their places in terms of culture. And those categories are the so-called transcultural things of worship, the cultural dimensions, the countercultural, and the cross-cultural. Those are the four categories. Under the first one, the transcultural, are basically the things we talked about earlier, the pattern. What is it about Christian worship that is shared across all cultures, no matter what they are? And under transcultural came things like the Bible. No matter where you go on the planet, if you go into a Christian service, you should hear something about or see a Bible someplace in the service. What else? Baptism, sacrament of baptism, communion. They may use different kinds of vessels or elements or what have you, but basically the Jesus meal is a transcultural part of worship. And you can go on. Some people will say the church year could be a transcultural. I mean, Advent, Christmas, Epiphany, Lent. It's just because it mirrors this, you know, the following the life of Christ, kind of dividing it up into segments. Lectionary. Maybe, might be transcultural, might not be. You can go through yourself and come up with a list of transcultural elements. Things that are, we call the recognizability factor, that if you're in a Christian worshiping group, you should be able to see things, no matter where you're from, that are recognizable. I was in Hungary a couple of years ago, and obviously don't know anything about Hungarian. It's one of the most unique languages in the world. I think it's only related to Finnish. No, it's not widely spoken by anybody but the Hungarians. I walked into a Hungarian Reformed church, never been in one in my life, but I knew exactly pretty much what was going on because the pattern of worship was there. I saw people take out plates, pass them down the chairs. I knew what they were doing. They were taking what Justin would call the collection for the poor. Same thing if you go to church in Germany. I mean, you see somebody standing up and singing, you know that this is a Christian gathering. Or you see somebody standing behind a whatever it is, a pulpit or what have you, you probably can figure out that there's something to do with exposition on the scriptures or inviting us into the pattern of the good things, as Justin would say. So there are those elements that need to be there, building blocks. Under cultural, that's where a lot of the creativity can come. And under cultural goes everything from styles of leadership, types of music used, styles of worship, quote unquote, all kinds of things that have to do with culture. Vesture, even that can be a cultural component. Or wearing it or not wearing it can be a cultural component. Or what kind it is, what kind of bread is used. The transcultural is this bread, or basically, or something that's an equivalent to bread in that culture if they don't have bread. But the fact is, you're celebrating the transcultural meal, the Jesus meal, in the local context. And every context will have to decide what that is. How communion is served is a cultural question. Yes.
I think we've spent a whole lot of time, money, and energy to develop a form of service or worship that will be acceptable to everybody and probably wipe out the cultures. I think we've tried to do that, to wipe out all this culture stuff. Sure.
How?
I think so.
Lutheran Book of Worship?
Well, music, for example. But haven't we tried for forever trying to get a uniform form of music?
Well, or yeah.
And worship.
Well,
you know, that would be accepted by everybody. I just noticed in this, in the last statement of the Augsburg Confession, in this little book, says it is not necessary for the true unity of the Christian Church that humanly instituted ceremonies should be observed uniformly in all places. That was written in 1530.
Mm-hmm. Right. But you know, as human beings have a capacity to take something that's a matter of freedom and turn it into a matter of law. Just classic Lutheran theological categories at work. What basically happened when we came over from Europe is that the German service and the Scandinavian service from Europe that was developed in freedom over there. You know, Luther, the German Mass was basically Luther's attempt to enculturate the Roman Mass for the German people. But that pattern itself became a new law in a way. When we came to North America, we had that pattern with us, and that became the new norm. I call it the, I'm not bashing the Lutheran Book of Worship at all. I love the Lutheran Book of Worship. But some people have taken the Lutheran Book of Worship now and made that the new standard. It's hence the call from the phone about the blue book. Where did that come from? That's not Lutheran. The green book is Lutheran. As if the LBW descended from the clouds and was given, you know, by Luther or something like that. The Lutheran Book of Worship has the pattern, the common pattern, but enculturated for the church of the time period that developed the Lutheran Book of Worship. And basically that was an attempt to bring the European ethnicities, Lutheran ethnicities on this country into one book. So if you notice the hymn collection of LBW, you can go and categorize it yourself. But it was basically a bargaining process between the Lutheran European ethnic groups. How many German chorales, as opposed to, we need some more Swedish folk tunes, we need Finnish, we need Danish. If you go through the LBW, all of those diverse European traditions found their way into the book. And that's what the book was designed to do, to bring together all these Lutherans from their variety of ethnicities. And that process began in the 60s and 70s. But if you notice, some of the people that started to come on boats later on, their traditions are not so much represented musically in the LBW, because that was not the project. The project was to bring together the European Lutheran traditions, and it did that very successfully. Some people might say there's too many German chorales, and that's the Missouri Synod's fault, because they wanted more German than Swedish or whatever. But basically, it brought together the European tradition. And that's why we've been publishing these other supplements, to bring some of the other traditions, not taking away what's there, but adding to it. That's why With One Voice, which actually tried to bring our church up to speed in terms of what has been happening in the past 10 years with church music and its diversity. If you notice in here, there's a lot of songs that have never before appeared in a Lutheran hymnal. Not only different ethnic diversities, but different diversities coming from different church backgrounds. There's a lot of revivalist music in here that people just love to sing. And I'm not even saying that's good or bad, but things like Blessed Assurance, Shall We Gather at the River, all these songs that come out of the so-called revivalist tradition, or you might find in a Methodist hymnal, but they've never ever been in a Lutheran hymnal until this book. So that's a new kind of diversity, accepting the music from other churches as valid, quote unquote. So With One Voice tried to introduce us to global music, revivalist, a little bit of the ethnic music from every source was kind of a potpourri. And the new Hispanic book tries to unite, in a way, be an LBW, in a way, for the Latino churches, for the first time to gather music from all of the traditions, Latino traditions that make up the ELCA. We have four communion settings in that book. One comes from the Church of Puerto Rico, representing that tradition. There's one that's a Mexican-based setting. There's one that's South America-based, and there's one other one, I think Southwestern US. Because there's so much diversity even within the Latino community. So they wrangled about how many mariachis as opposed to how many whatever, all these different categories. And they have a book that unifies that tradition. But it's also available to the wider church. In the African American book, we're trying to do the same thing. Bring together sources of African derived music, whether it's from the Caribbean or from the African church, from the spiritual tradition, the gospels. Even praise music is in the African American, because that's a transcultural thing that seems to be popular across the board. So bringing in, we're not taking away anything, we're not shipping away, we're adding to the diversity. And congregations now have the task of dealing with diversity. The project's just beginning. Every worship community in every parish will have to take a look at the context, your community, the ethnic makeup, the cultural makeup, all the different cultures, and craft worship based on the pattern that's appropriate for that community. But still, it's recognizable. We have to have a unity factor, and that's where the pattern comes in, to hold us accountable to the tradition that we've inherited from 2,000 years of Christian history. I brought with me some of a study resource that we did for the North American Lutherans based on the LWF study. And I don't think I have enough of these for everybody, but whoever's interested in one, take one. And those of you who don't get a copy of it, you can get thousands of copies of these for $1 a piece. You can do a study in your worship committee. You just call Augsburg Fortress, and it's getting ready for worship for the 21st century. And I also brought along a copy of a new resource that one of my colleagues in the worship office has put together. It's called Sound Decisions. Evaluating contemporary music for Lutheran worship, because contemporary music and all that is culture related, and some congregations are doing services that have a lot of this so-called contemporary music. And a lot of that music comes from non-Lutheran sources, and congregations have been asking for how do we, amongst this canon of contemporary music, find stuff that's appropriate for Lutheran usage. And this resource tries to give some tools. Pass those around. Who's ever interested or a congregation that's dealing with contemporary music might want to take one. Anyone else can just call Augsburg. It's available. Just came out in the past year or so. And get copies of that for your worship. We're going to be talking, these issues are going to kind of follow us throughout the week, anyone who comes to a worship session.